Around the world, people are working to bring a greater sense of balance to the planet. Earth Wisdom Circles is here to showcase these people and projects. Now, here's your host for Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio, Elaine Grohman.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Elaine Grohman on Earth Wisdom Circles. Today, my guest is Dr. Stephen Terzyak, who is a physician scientist, chief of medicine at Cooper University Healthcare, and a professor and chief of medicine at Cooper Medical School in Rowan, in Camden, New Jersey. What really intrigued me about when I learned about his work as not only a global researcher, but in particular, the need for compassion in the medical world. And he is the author, the co-author of a book called Compassionomics, the revolutionary science evidence that caring makes a difference. So welcome to the show, Doctor.
Thank you very much, Elaine.
Please tell me, first of all, as a researcher, what brought you to want to write this book and to really understand the significance and the importance of compassion in human care, but also especially in healthcare?
So I actually was not in the market for any sort of change of trajectory of my research career. I spent the first 20 years of my career studying resuscitation science in the ICU. That is the study of patients who are resuscitated from cardiac arrest. And specifically, I'm an intensive care doctor by background. I work in the ICU here at Cooper. My team and I, we were trying to determine what is the optimal oxygen level in the blood that would prevent or lower the risk of permanent brain injury after resuscitation from cardiac arrest. And I did that for 20 years. And then I had a pivot or change in trajectory. And now I study compassion in healthcare. And really the story started with an unexpected question from a 12-year-old. So that 12-year-old was my son. And one day he asked me for help. He said, "Dad, I know you do a lot of research, so you give a lot of talks. Can you help me prepare mine? I have to give a talk for my class at school." And I thought, this is going to be awesome. You know, a fantastic father-son bonding opportunity. Little did I know what was in store for me. So I said, "What's your talk about?" And he reached into his backpack and he pulled out a sheet of paper and he put it down on my desk. And here was what was written on there, the assignment for his talk at school. The question was this: what is the most pressing problem of our time? Seventh grade. So
what
I don't know what
subject.
I don't know what you were doing in seventh grade, Elaine, but I was not doing what is the most pressing problem of our time. Now there's no such thing as the one most pressing problem of our time. It's all about your lens of experience and in your corner of the world. What it did for me is it set me off on an existential crisis of sorts, because the research that I was working on was important, no doubt. But did I really believe it was the most pressing problem of our time through my lens of experience as a physician scientist and leader? No. So I had to find it. And what I found, along with my colleague Anthony Mazzarelli, we found an abundant evidence that we have a compassion crisis in healthcare, literally a crisis. And there are many data behind that to show that that's true. So the real big question is, does it matter? I mean, does compassion really matter? And you may say, of course, compassion matters. It's a cornerstone of the art of medicine. We have a moral and ethical imperative to treat patients with compassion. Of course, I've always agreed with that, but that's not the question. The question is compassion just in the art of medicine, where there's an ought and a moral imperative? Or there are also evidence-based effects belonging in the science of medicine. And so that started a two-year journey through the biomedical literature for Dr. Mazzarelli and I. And what we uncovered was a striking signal that, yes, compassion matters not just in meaningful ways, but also in measurable ways. So what we like to do is look at familiar things in an unfamiliar way. So rather than looking at compassion through an emotional, sentimental lens or a moral ethical lens, we look at compassion through the lens of science. And what we found is that there's abundant science in the art of medicine, and the science is strong.
Well, what I found so interesting in having had the opportunity to work with people in medicine, particular medical schools, is it was almost trained out of them to be compassionate, to be more analytical, to be more separate from those that they were caring so intimately for. So as a physician yourself, and having gone through medical school and the innumerable work that you have done with patients, how did you see it through that lens of having how you had been trained versus what you knew and were experiencing as what was needed?
I remember distinctly as a young medical student in the early 1990s, I remember being taught, don't care too much, because too much caring, too much compassion will burn you out. And a lot of my contemporaries, people that started training at that time and earlier, were taught that. It was what we would call the hidden curriculum. So it's not the explicit or overt curriculum that's written down in the textbooks and in the journal articles. It's actually in something that you learn through socialization. And you learn it in the halls and the call rooms of hospitals and academic medical centers all across the country. And we all were taught that. And I believed that for almost 25 years. But here's the problem. When you look at the evidence, and we synthesized all the evidence for this in the biomedical literature and our work for Compassionomics, when you synthesize the evidence and you analyze it, you see a very different signal in the data. So we have a burnout epidemic in healthcare. For those of your listeners that are healthcare providers, they're well aware of that data, but there's reports that between 30 and nearly 50% of physicians, for example, in the United States are suffering from at least moderate levels of burnout. And that's also true for nurses and all healthcare professionals. This just hasn't been studied as much as it has been studied in physicians. So there are less data in other caregiver roles, but it's there as well. And there's a burnout epidemic. By the way, you don't have to be a healthcare provider to feel burned out, especially not in 2021, right?
Right.
And we had a burnout epidemic that was found in healthcare long before there was a pandemic. So my thinking is that maybe this idea that too much caring, too much compassion will burn you out, maybe that's been contributing to the problem. When you look at the evidence in the biomedical literature and you synthesize it all, there is, in fact, a signal, an association between compassion and burnout. But it's inverse. So if what I was taught in medical school, that too much caring, too much compassion will burn you out, then you would see an association that goes in the same direction. You would see high compassion, high burnout, low compassion, low burnout. But what you see when you synthesize the evidence is high compassion, low burnout, low compassion, high burnout. It's inverse. Right. So what could explain that? And the short answer is, well, we don't really know. But I have a hypothesis. And when you look at the totality of the evidence, as we curated, there are over 280 original science research papers curated in the book Compassionomics. What you see in that inverse association and the totality of evidence around it is that the data suggests that if you don't have compassion for patients, then you don't get that fulfilling relationship. You don't get that. That's the fulfilling part of what it means to take care of patients. It's that relationship that you have with your patients. And if you don't have that, then all you're left with is a really stressful job.
Yeah.
And so the available evidence suggests that by caring more and having better relationships that flow from that through enhanced patient trust, and that bond with your patient, that builds resilience and buffers one's risk of burnout. And so the available evidence suggests that compassion for patients can actually be protective.
Well, it's interesting because I would imagine that it would be important to look at, since you are in relationship as a physician to your patient, the way you think about whatever you're doing is immediately causing a chemical reaction within your body. So if you're blocking that essential emotion of human care, i.e. compassion, then what are you doing to yourself? Aside from the fact that what are you not allowing to be elicited with a true relationship between caregiver and patient and or whomever you're in relationship with in life?
Exactly. So there is compelling scientific evidence that serving others is the best medicine for yourself. So you mentioned a chemical reaction. Well, there are actually four different hormones that are involved in that response. And we also know this from neuroscience data showing functional MRI data showing that serving others and actually connecting with compassion activates a neural structure in the brain that is a reward center. So when you have, and actually I should just make have some distinction in terms here, because if we're going to have a scientific approach, nomenclature is very important.
Absolutely.
So compassion is typically defined in research spaces anyway, as an emotional response to another's pain or suffering involving an authentic desire to help. So it is different from a closely related term, empathy. So empathy is the sensing, detecting, feeling, and understanding another's pain and suffering. But compassion goes beyond empathy in that it involves taking action to alleviate someone's pain or suffering to whatever extent is possible. Now, empathy is vitally important because if you don't sense, detect, feel, or understand another's pain or suffering, you'll miss it completely. You'll just miss it. You'll miss the opportunity to respond to patients with compassion because you'll never see the opportunity. So we like to say empathy plus action equals compassion. And there are neuroscience data to support these distinctions in terms. So, for example, using functional MRI, it's a brain scan that can show what part of the brain is being activated at any given moment in time. When you have when you bear witness to pain and suffering, you know experientially it's uncomfortable. It is uncomfortable to watch someone suffer. But what neuroscience research shows is that it actually activates the pain center in your brain. So there is neuroscience behind the saying, I feel your pain. Yes. Distinctly different, I should say. When your mind is focused on compassion and alleviating someone's pain or suffering to whatever extent possible, functional MRI research has actually shown that a distinctly different neural structure is activated in the brain. It's actually a reward center that is associated with positive affect, positive emotion, and a feeling of affiliation. And so the research actually supports that empathy hurts, but compassion heals. And so the when I said there's ample evidence that serving others is the best medicine for yourself, that's true not only from neuroscience data, but the hormones that we mentioned. So we're talking about endorphins, dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin. We all know experientially that it feels good to help people, right? And so that's a combination of all those things, including activation of distinct neural structures that are reward centers in the brain. And then there are downstream effects of that for your physical health, for your own mental health, for your well-being and happiness, even for success. So there's ample evidence behind what we're talking about today.
Let's go on a little further, Doctor, in helping us to understand. You were speaking about empathy and compassion. So From my understanding, as a mother and as a grandmother and as a caregiver, because I've been a caregiver many times in my life, it's that desire to, you do indeed feel that there is a challenge that that individual is feeling. And it elicits within you this resonance, for lack of a better way to say it. And you understand the chemical reaction hormonally that greater than I. But it isn't that part of the way humanity is designed to have our senses provide the information that is so necessary for us to help one another in various ways. And what is a challenge, I believe, as you mentioned, in so many people in medicine being burned out, is that they've been asked to switch that off and really not truly being able to pretend that they could.
So when we talk about burnout, sometimes there are some other terms that are used. Some people use the term compassion fatigue. I actually think people have empathy fatigue because they bear witness to suffering so frequently and feel that they don't have a capacity to make a difference. And then that's what causes them their own personal distress. So when you, you mentioned that, isn't it in our nature? And so the short answer is yes, but only to some extent. So we've done research on this as well. And certainly there are people who are, perhaps better, equipped, to detect another one's pain or suffering and then to respond to it with compassion. Stanford's Dr. Jamil Zaki has synthesized the evidence and has determined that about 30% of our capacity for empathy is probably genetic. But what that means is that the rest is not. And so I used to believe that people were either wired for compassion or they were not. It's either in your DNA or the fabric of who you are, or it's not. And then, and I believed that for a long time too, but the evidence in the scientific literature shows quite clearly that compassionate behaviors, that is how you behave, not what you think in your mind or feel in your heart, but how you behave towards another person, can in fact be taught and learned. And so this has been shown broadly throughout psychological science, but also in healthcare. My colleagues here at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University that I collaborated with, Dr. Brian Roberts is our science director. We published a systematic review and qualitative meta-analysis last year in the journal PLOS ONE. And what we found is that in the history of the medical literature, there have been 54 different papers that have tested some sort of an empathy or compassion training program, trying to train people in behaviors. And what we found is that 3/4 of them have, in fact, moved the needle, so to speak, on compassion in some way that has been measurable. And so both inside of healthcare and broadly in the general population, the evidence supports that even though there may be something intrinsic or even genetic about our capacity for empathy and compassion, that behaviors can in fact be taught and learned. And that's good news indeed. That's good news for me, for sure, because I am a work in progress. There's no doubt about that. The difference is that I see it now. I see it now. And because I see it now, I'm working hard to get better at compassion every day, working hard to get better at connecting with patients and with families in my ICU. So just like I work on my technical skills with the ventilator or procedures that we perform at the bedside, I'm working hard to get better at compassion every day. And thankfully, science shows that I can.
Well, you know, I find that so interesting. And thank you so much for that explanation. And I think that as an intensivist, I think that you have a unique position, maybe different than other physicians, That you, if you have an unconscious patient, certainly you have all of the equipment that can show you what biologically is happening, physiologically is happening, but you, a machine doesn't pick up a grimace or a flinch necessarily. Mm-hmm. So I always thought that individuals like physicians who are pediatricians, intensivists, and veterinarians have to have a more highly skilled sense of awareness because their patients cannot necessarily tell them what's wrong. So I think that you're unique in that because of the choice of specialty you have selected.
Well, I would respond with two thoughts on that. One is you're absolutely right that even though my specialty is very much data driven, we're working with a lot of numbers and formulas and calculations, which is very different than, for example, a primary care physician who may be having deep conversations about one's troubles and struggles in life. But that being said, to your point, there are many things that can't be quantified into data that can appear on my spreadsheet or my computer screen. And that's why physical examination and being proximate to the patient, you have to go to the bedside. And you can detect lots of things that are not encompassed on the cardiac monitor or on the ventilator waveforms. That's one. Number two is that while it's true that many of my patients actually can't speak with me, and I never get the opportunity to talk to them sometimes, I can always talk to their families, who are often grieving over a bad diagnosis or a critical condition, as much as anybody, including the patients. And so there's a uniqueness there about the work that we do in the ICU. And we approach that in a very serious way because there are data to show that what patients experience in the ICU and what their families experience in the ICU turn into lasting memories that just echo on and perhaps never go away.
Yes. So again, my guest is Dr. Stephen Kreziak, who is the author, co-author of a wonderful book called Compassionomics.
Thank you.
The Revolutionary Scientific Evidence That Caring Makes a Difference. Can you please tell us, how has this book impacted your colleagues or those that are in medicine, whether they're the caregiver or the administrator or whomever it is that's involved in the whole global network of healthcare? How have you seen that this book and your research has helped to broaden their perspective?
So I think that it all relates to mindset. So historically, compassion has been viewed through a lens of being a nice to have in medicine. Many, many people, or even most, would consider it essential because of the imperative to treat people in a humanistic fashion. But what we do in the book is we try to reset the mindset. And to our knowledge, it's the first time that all the evidence that compassion makes measurable differences, not just meaningful differences. It's the first time it's all been curated and pushed together in one place. And when you see the totality of the evidence curated in that way, you see this signal that is striking. And once you see that signal, you won't think the same way about your compassion again. You'll think differently about it. You will realize that it's more powerful than you ever imagined. And once you think of it in that way, as not just a nice to have or a moral imperative, then you want to get better at it every opportunity that you have.
I think that is so true, because as we think about how we bring ourselves to the world, you know, we're so responsible for how we bring ourselves to every situation. Mm-hmm. And as you had mentioned earlier, Doctor, that, you know, some people may or may not be hardwired, but I think it's so situational driven. If you are in a situation where there is a great deal of trauma around you, then you could either shut it off entirely or become even more compassionate. So I think that there's so many things that we have to look at in how do we treat one another, and is compassion then helping us to mitigate perhaps some of the disease processes that are happening? If we're compassionate to ourselves, would that mean that we would take better care of our physiology, that we would be more open to healthy relationships, to eat well, to be more physical, to enjoy life differently? Have you thought about how that has that immediate impact in how we see ourselves?
Yeah, so we're actually curating all that evidence now. So in a new project that's really like compassionomics for the general population rather than just for healthcare workers, and effects on patients and on patient care and those who care for patients, but just for health and well-being in general. I think I mentioned earlier that there's abundant evidence that serving others is the best medicine for yourself. Yeah. And it's not only through these activation of neural pathways and the physiology with the four different hormones with endorphins, dopamine, serotonin, and oxytocin, but serving others is a stress buffering activity. It lowers cortisol levels in the blood. Not to mention just experientially, we just know that it feels good to help other people. And so what happens when you do that over a lifetime? Well, there's evidence that it impacts longevity, that people who serve others routinely on average will live longer, that they will also have it in later in life, be able to have higher walking speeds and functional activity, functional status, and as well as even sleep better at night, which I think we've all experienced that when you lay down, when you lay your head down at the end of a day and you're really tired, but it's a good tired, like you knew you did the right thing and you help people as much as you can, you sleep better. Well, there's scientific evidence behind that. Not to mention all the mental health benefits of serving others. So serving others lowers depression symptoms in people who suffered from depression. It also buffers the risk of developing depression symptoms. It lowers anxiety levels in people who suffer from anxiety. It has a wealth of there are a wealth of studies which show that serving others is associated with better well-being and even happiness, however you might define that.
I think that is so fascinating. And you as a physician, obviously, I'm presuming, so please correct me if I'm wrong, your focus is the patient. But also, how do you begin to broaden that awareness of your coworkers in every level of those individuals who are contributing in one way or another to the care of the patient under your name? You know, whether that is the nurse or the aide or the janitor even, or the one who's preparing the food and bringing the food. Mm-hmm. How does that begin to change healthcare, do you think, when everyone is seen as significant in the roles that they play?
So one, in our journey through the evidence over the last few years, one signal has been not only clear but consistent through all the data. And that signal is this: the key to resilience is relationships. The key to resilience is relationships. So I shared with you earlier, your relationships with your patients can build your resilience and buffer your stress and make you less likely to be experiencing symptoms of burnout. That's if you're a healthcare provider. But it's not just your relationships with your patients. It's your relationships with everybody. It's your relationships with your colleagues. It's your relationships with everyone on the staff. It's your relationships at home. It's your relationships with your friends and your family. That Historically, we've sought solace in communion with other people when we go through times of struggle. There was an NIH sponsored survey a couple of years back, which showed that trends in what we now call self-care are becoming more and more isolating. You know, rather than seeking solace in family and friends and those relationships, now we're more apt to do things like, you know, put on your headphones and listen to your meditation app on your phone, or get into some other thing on your phone, or do your yoga where you're maybe you're on a mat in a room full of people, but you're really just all inside yourself, or go off by yourself and do nature hikes, more isolating. And the evidence that I'm aware of shows that that actually puts you at higher risk for burnout, where relationships are really the key to resilience. And so it, relationships with all those around you, so not just my patients, but all my colleagues, all the nurses in the ICU, the staff, my friends, the security guards, all my relationships at home with my family. Those are the things that actually helped me to get out of burnout, because I went through burnout myself.
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So after 20 years of working in an ICU, and what we do in an ICU, and I don't mean this to sound dramatic, but I just want to, for anybody who's not familiar with that, you not uncommonly, or may perhaps even often, you are meeting patients and their families on the worst day of their life.
Yes.
Literally. And that's pretty heavy. And after 20 years of that, I came to this stark realization that I had every symptom of burnout myself. So what was I supposed to do? Well, I'm a research nerd. That's, you know, I do research, and research nerds have a certain approach. Research nerds like to look into the literature and say, what's the evidence on this, right? So I found the evidence for treatments of burnout. And they were all recommending things that all these papers were recommending things. I just wasn't buying it. I mean, they were recommending things like go on more vacations, take more nature hikes, all these things that were like get away. And so really the theory behind all these, I call it escapism. Now, by the way, I just want to say work-life balance is critically important. I think that's pretty much settled now, that you need to have balance, at least to some extent. So I'm not saying that's not important, but what I'm saying is I if you are in burnout, right? And so the three cornerstones of the burnout syndrome, and again, you don't have to be a healthcare provider to go through burnout, but it's three things: emotional exhaustion, depersonalization, which is an inability to make a personal connection, and then the feeling that you can't make a difference. So emotional exhaustion, depersonalization, feeling it like you can't make a difference. And I was 3 for 3 in that framework. So what was I supposed to do? Well, if I bought into the escapism thinking, you know, get away more, take nature hikes, go on more vacations, go do yoga, just get away, then if you buy that, then you're buying into the philosophy that the antidote to burnout is just to get away from my patients as much as possible, and then everything will be fine. And I wasn't buying it, because while work-life balance is of course necessary and vital, I wasn't buying that the key was an escape. I thought that something had to change at the point of care. So that's when my colleagues and I became aware of the data, and Anthony Mazzarelli and I devote a chapter on this in Compassionomics, that inverse association, the evidence that compassion can be a beneficial therapy for the giver too, that compassion can actually be protective for you and promote resilience and resistance to burnout. I became aware of that. So I decided to do an experiment on myself. So I call it my, you know, I'm a research nerd, right? So I call it my N of one experiment. There was only one research subject in this experiment, and that research subject was me. So I decided very intentionally that I was going to test the compassion hypothesis for myself. So rather than detaching and pulling back and getting away, I was going to lean in and care more, not less. Sit down more and have more meaningful family meetings with patients and families in the ICU, and try to care and connect more rather than detaching and pulling back. And it wasn't just with my patients or with their families, but it was with the nurses in the ICU, with my colleagues in the ICU, with my trainees and my medical students and my and the staff in the ICU, my staff here in the Department of Medicine that I'm the chair of, my relationships at home, connect more, not less. And that was when the fog of burnout began to lift for me. That changed everything. Sure. So, you know,
that's very powerful.
And it was powerful for me because we had just curated, you know, 280 original science research papers that are in compassionomics, but you add that to a powerful N of one experiment. And, you know, that's when we decided, well, this needs to be a book. So, that's how the book.
Well, I'm certainly glad that you came out with this book.
Well, thank you.
It's very important. And you know, since the title itself, Compassionomics, implies economics, and so what has been the economic benefit, would you say, for this awareness of the need for compassion in healthcare to be more globally accepted? How has that affected a change, would you say?
So first, I'll say that we actually didn't intend it to resonate with economics. We were coming across, you know, we come from the biological sciences. So Dr. Maz and I were thinking of genomics, proteomics, metabolomics, right? So, right. The reason why we named it compassionomics is because what we uncovered in our journey through the evidence is what we consider to be the convergence of the science and the art of medicine. And so that's why we named it compassionomics. And, but to your point, there are very important economic effects of more compassion. And it actually dovetails with exactly what we've been talking about with burnout and resilience. So for example, as you can imagine, because this is true throughout so many different industries, your biggest expense for your organization is often labor, right? And yes. Healthcare workers, you know, we've got 8,500 employees at Cooper University Healthcare, and of those, we have almost 800 physicians. And what the evidence shows, and this is was published in Annals of Internal Medicine just a couple of years ago, and they studied it specifically for physicians, but it actually could be applicable, although the calculations would be different. It could be applicable across all different caregiver roles. But what they found is that when a physician leaves an organization because they're burned out, and now this is true anytime a physician would leave an organization, but physicians are leaving organizations and leaving medicine in droves because of burnout. So it's in the context of burnout that we're having the discussion, and that's what the paper was targeting. But in general, it costs a healthcare system between $500,000 and $1 million when that happens. And the reason why is because you have to wind down a physician's practice. Then you have to recruit a new physician. Sometimes the new physician is going to cost you more. Then that physician arrives at your organization and doesn't have a practice. They have to build that up over the course of 2 years, typically. And so when you look all in at the cost of that, when you lose a physician because of burnout, it's really expensive. And then you multiply that across all the different physicians in your organization that might apply to. But then you apply it across, you know, we have 8,500 employees. And I told you, you don't have to be a frontline healthcare worker to feel burned out. So I think in the context of resilience and burnout, there is an enormous cost. There's an enormous cost to healthcare, but there are costs to all sectors because of failures, systematic failures to that relate to well-being and resilience. And so it's in, you know, I could quote you a lot of papers that show that more compassionate physicians use less tests, fewer unnecessary admissions to the hospital, fewer unnecessary referrals to specialists and all those things. I believe that the real opportunity is in resilience and burnout and in employee turnover. Because that's where the real costs are. They're sometimes harder to quantify and different methodologies have been used, but that is, it's taking an enormous economic toll on our healthcare system.
Thank you for that. Can you please tell me where is the best place for people to reach you and how can they get your book?
Sure. You can go to compassionomics.com and there's a link for the book, or you can reach out to us via the website.
Okay. And so as you're going forward, how have you seen this work that you have been so diligently and obviously very consciously looking at? How has it broadened your own perspective of life in what you do every day? I know you've spoken about it a little bit, but how is it giving you a sense of ease, perhaps, or has it?
It has. It's also shown me opportunity. What I mean by that is we studied it somewhat, I don't want to say narrowly, but we studied it in the context of healthcare. But the lessons from the work that we've already done and the project that we're currently working on right now is really applicable to so many other walks of life and scenarios. You know, teachers, for example, teachers go through burnout at high rate. Other helping professions, police officers, firefighters, people in the criminal justice system. I could just, you know, go on and on. Social workers, right? So, but even outside of those that are in helping professions, there's evidence that serving other people has powerful, beneficial effects for yourself. And so that's our current project. That's what we're working on now. And, you know, the scope of that, because what I told you about my N of one experiment and how more human connection actually built resilience and got me out of burnout. That can't only be true for healthcare workers. There's no way, right? Yeah. So what we've been doing is curating the evidence that same effect of leaning into relationships and serving other people applies broadly to everybody, not just the 9 million Americans that are working in the healthcare industry.
I think that is so brilliant. And I really want to applaud you for your participation in the most recent Fifth International Vatican Conference.
Oh, thank you.
Can you tell us about how that took place? I know we just have maybe 5 minutes left, less than 5 minutes, 3 minutes. Tell us about how that has affected you as a physician, being in a so much larger global conversation.
I'd love to. So participating in the Vatican Conference was one of the highlights of my, you know, 25 plus year career. I was invited because my colleague, Bill Mobley, who is the director of the Sanford Institute at the University of California, San Diego, invited me to participate. His institute was sponsoring this session. And we had just a fantastic dialogue with not only neuroscientists, but I got to offer my clinical perspective. And That conference is so special because it doesn't just bring in, you know, nerdy researchers like me, right? It brings in spiritual leaders, religious leaders, celebrities, sports figures, and policymakers, to have just a very broad discussion about impact of compassion on health in the broad sense. And so it was amazingly just enriching for me to be a part of it. I'm very grateful to Dr. Mobley and colleagues for that opportunity.
Well, it was because of listening to that particular segment on that conference that I knew I wanted to have you on the show. So I'm appreciative of that as well. So well, I know that you. I really honor your time, and I thank you so very much for what you have been willing to do to help us see ourselves better. Dr. Stephen Terziak, I hope I just pronounced it correctly. I'm sorry if I did
you
not.
Did.
Okay, great. And I would highly recommend that you go to their website, compassionomics.com, and or find that book and read it. It's important. And that we continue to have this conversation with ourselves, with our family, with whatever industry you're in. When we bring compassion to the world, we will make it a better place. Thank you so much, Doctor, for what you do. I'm looking forward to your second book and hearing what you have to say. Maybe we can have you back on the show.
Thank you so much, Elaine. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. This is Elaine Groman on Earth Wisdom Circles. Remember that you too, no matter what walk of life you are in, can open your heart and make this world a better place. It's up to us as human beings. Thank you.